Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Gregory M. Kleins, assistant professor at the Department of Religion at Trinity University. We'll be speaking about a fascinating new 2022 Routledge publication, Jain Ramayana Narratives, Moral Vision and Literary Innovation. Gregory, welcome to the podcast.
So thank you so much, Raj. Longtime listener. Very glad to be here.
Well, we have a longtime listener, so you know exactly what you're getting into. I'm going to critique the hell out of your work. Yep. So you're well aware that we are just prompting some general takeaways for a larger public audience. Mm-hmm. And this is a topic, I mean, frankly, the vast majority of these works, if not all of them, I find fascinating for a variety of reasons. But rumor has it, I've studied the Ramayana before. It was the topic of my master's work at the University of Toronto. Mm. And over the course of the master's, I did it half time. I was mastering half time. Sure. And I had a trip to India in 2008, I believe, with the International Summer School for Jain Studies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
And ended up discovering that Jain Ramayanas are fairly different. There's a great deal of difference.
Absolutely,
far from monolithic or Ramayana traditions, mm-hmm. but there are some fascinating innovations that we see in Jain Ramayanas. But mm-hmm. enough about that topic from me, more from you. So how did you end up studying Jain Ramayanas?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of happened by accident. I did not enter into my PhD program thinking I was going to do a Ramayana project. I knew I wanted to work on Jains. I had been introduced to Jainism as an undergrad at the University of Virginia. Karen Lang taught a seminar on Jainism, and I was already a religion major, had already started Sanskrit and taken a few classes in South Asian studies. And that course sort of hooked me. And so by the time I started working on my PhD, I knew I wanted to work on Jainism. And I happened across in Widener Library at Harvard a book in Hindi on this guy named Brahmacharan Jinnadas, and sort of realized he was a super prolific author that no one had really worked on in the Euro-American Academy. The project extended from there. And so I sort of discovered that he had written two Ramayanas. He wrote one in Sanskrit called the Padma Purana, and then also one in a sort of North Indian vernacular Pasha language, essentially. And I was interested in that sort of diglossic text composition, right? Why do people write in both Sanskrit and vernacular? And then as I was researching, I realized that the Sanskrit Padma Purana that Jinnadas wrote was clearly a rewrite of an earlier Jain Ramayana from like 800 years earlier by this guy named Ravi Shaina. And Jinnadasa is explicit in saying that he wants to make Ravi Shaina's text clear. And so the project sort of emerged out of thinking about the question, well, what does he mean by clarity? why does he rewrite? Why doesn't he write something like a commentary? What does textual recomposition do for religious communities? And then again, why rewrite something in vernacular after you've written the thing in Sanskrit? So those were the sort of basic questions that led to me looking at the two sort of primary subjects of the book.
Yeah, there are a number of really interesting themes in the work that you do. I mean, obviously, I'm quite fond of studying the Ramayana. That's how I ended up finishing a master's. Yep. Otherwise, I would have dropped out into something else. But perhaps the pressures of destiny were upon me. Who knows? But aside from the rich, profound story of Rama, we see this tension in Puranic study all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, text versus retelling versus interpolation versus, you know, thinking of the text as a tradition, thinking of all of the iterations as part of a web of Ramayana traditions. And then on top of that, you've got, well, what makes these tellings Jaina? How do they rework them for that milieu? And on top of that, you've got an individual who sees himself as commentating on someone from 8 centuries before.
Yep.
And so there are all these different layers of storytelling, these frames of access. Mm-hmm. And so maybe a good place to start just for the audience is to help us understand, you know, why do the Jains tell the story of Rama, or how might they tell them differently overarchingly from what we might typically consider key elements of the story of Rama?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, obviously the fact of, or the idea of Ram being an incarnation of Vishnu, which is prevalent in most we call Brahminical or Hindu versions of the Ramayana, is absent. Jains rewrite the Ramayana to place Ram, his brother, and his brother Lakshman and Ravana within this larger sort of schema of what they call the Shalaka Purushas, the 63 illustrious men of Jain universal history. And then there's a lot of sort of content changes that Jains make as well. So Ravana becomes a much more likable character in a lot of Jain Ramayanas, certainly in comparison to Valmiki. He's a good Jain king. He has a particular sort of devotional affinity for Shantinata, one of the Jinnas of the most recent current world age. And he sort of suffers from this one sort of issue, this character flaw of sort of egoism and pride. And that sort of expresses itself in when he sees Sita for the first time, that sort of rears up and he decides that he has to have her. And that's why he abducts her. Kaikeyi is another sort of character who becomes softened, I would say, in Jain Ramayanas. She isn't worried about losing her place at court. She concocts this plan to exile Ram and Sita and Lakshmana because she's worried that her biological son Bharata is going to follow Dasharatha, the king, into mendicancy, into Jain, and to become a Jain renunciate. And so it's this very maternal worry that she has. And then there's a sort of larger sort of process by which, and this has been documented before me, Jains try to sort of remove a lot of what they call the fantastical elements of the story. Not all the fantastical elements, but the fact that Kumbhakarna sleeps for 6 months out of the year or something like that, they sort of question, right? Or how could a group of monkeys defeat Ravana, these sorts of things. So the Vanaras, what are monkeys in Valmiki, are just a group of individuals, a clan of people who have the monkey as their banner, and they're not actual monkeys. And so there's a lot of sort of those renegotiations, I would say, or rewritings of the story.
Tell us a little bit, perhaps, about the role of violence and maybe the karmic the consequences of violence. And then, you know, Rama's prime dharma is kshatriya, and, you know, a wielder of justified force in the Hindu world. And how does that get reworked, if at all?
Yeah, so that's part of this idea of the illustrious men. So Rama in the sort of Jain illustrious men schema is called a Baladeva. He is a sort of perfect Jain hero who actually does not commit violence. So in, I would say, most Jain Ramayanas, it's actually Lakshmana who kills Ravana and not Ram. And so Lakshmana's sort of character is called a Vasudeva, who is the sort of sidekick of the Baladeva and does a lot of the Baladeva's sort of violent, dirty work. And so that's why Lakshmana ends up killing Ravana, you know, towards the end, not at the actual end, but towards the end. And then Ravana is cast as, in the schema, as the Prati Vasudeva. And there are long accounts of how the Vasudeva and the Prati Vasudeva have gone through, you know, subsequent lifetimes upon lifetimes upon lifetimes of warring with each other or animosity towards each other. And that all culminates in when Lakshmana ends up killing Ravana. And so because of that, both Lakshmana and Ravana, because they perform these acts of violence, because they are not these sort of perfect embodiments of nonviolence, of ahimsa, the central tenet in Jainism, they immediately go to hell in the lives that they, you know, once they die in the story. And there's a lot of descriptions in Jain Ramayanas about their condition there. And in fact, the character who was Sita, in a future birth, tries to go to hell. She's reborn as a god. She goes to hell and tries to rescue Lakshmana from hell. And the texts are very clear. Obviously, she can't do that. Lakshmana has to work off the bad karma that his soul has accrued. And so there's this really nice sort of metaphor that Lakshmana's hand slips through hers like melting butter in a fire, and so she can't rescue him. But Ram is seen as this sort of paragon of nonviolence, as a Baladeva, and then Lakshmana and Ravana suffer the consequences, the karmic repercussions of the violence they perform throughout the story. And that's reproduced in other sort of sets of the Baladeva, Vasudeva, and Prativasudeva in this sort of Salaka Purusha schema.
Such a beautiful literary image of the melting butter, particularly insofar as Sita is so pure that she's untouched by fire, where, you know, ghee or karma or Lakshmana can be burnt, but, you know, her hand doesn't get burnt. Beautiful metaphor.
Yep.
And, you know, because I'm slightly preoccupied with ethics of violence, this kind of innovation, this Jain innovation of, well, Rama doesn't really fulfill the Kshatriya Dharma, and to the extent that he does, he's punished for it. This is a key difference. How's your book structured?
So the book is structured around sort of two ideas or claims or sort of basic questions. First is I want to highlight the differences between Jain versions of the Ramayana. Oftentimes Jain Ramayanas are sort of talked about monolithically. And this is one way in which I think, you know, Jain studies and Jain literary studies is a bit behind Hindu studies or Buddhist studies and these sorts of things. We haven't really embraced the internal diversity of our own texts, right, or of Jain texts. And so it's very clear, and this emerged from reading Jinadasa's Padma Purana, he has this sort of stated goal. He wants to create clarity out of Ravi Shainas. He's doing a new textual project, and he's making specific changes in order to achieve that. And then he goes and rewrites the same story in Bhasha, in the vernacular. And so I'm prioritizing or sort of foregrounding difference as what I'm looking for, what I'm reading for among and between these versions that purport, of course, to tell the same story. And then second, I'm interested in thinking about what those differences mean in terms of how texts create moral persons, how they shape the literary strategies they use to make people better, to make people more ethical. And what emerges from a reading for difference and thinking about ethical subjectivity is that it's not just that each of the different texts I analyze trains people to be moral differently. It's that they actually have different ideas of what it means to be a moral person. What does a good person actually look like? And so that's what I try to get across throughout the book. And so I can go sort of into more detail if you want.
No, that's great. And we will go more into detail. This big idea is very important, to the extent to which perhaps arguably the purpose, the prime objective of narrative is to communicate, and to communicate a theme of a narrative isn't 2 + 2 = 4. The theme of narrative in general is in the moral of the story. We have this expression in English, and whether it's you know, you have the very clear, like in Aesop's fables or not, like in the Ramayana tradition, this seems very apropos to studying narrative, which is just juicing it for the ethical essence that's internalized, assumed that the text is trying to pass on to generations. So, why does Jinadasa feel the need to rewrite Ravishena's iteration?
He thinks it's too poetic. It's too complicated. there's too much. There's too much that sort of detracts or distracts from the progress of the story. That's what Jinadasa says. So the book starts actually with an analysis of Ravishena's Padma Purana, which is this beautiful piece of kavya, Sanskrit Belles Lettres. It's this absolutely wonderful, poetically sort of difficult in places, piece of Sanskrit. And so what the first chapter does is analyze Ravishena as a work of kavya, and kavya that is trying to inculcate in the reader the sort of primary rasa, the angi rasa of shanta, of the quiescent sentiments, which is very common in Jain kavya. And then to think about the ways in which the creation of shanta in the reader sort of pushes them or tries to get them to renounce the world, to become a Jain renunciant. So the paragon of ethical personhood for Ravishena is this sort of emotionally attuned person who realizes that escaping the world, leaving the world behind, is the sort of ultimate ethical action, right? And a lot of that work is done through emotional manipulation of the reader that Ravishena is very, very good at. He particularly sort of manipulates the reader's experience of grief. And so I can go into more into that. And then what Jinadasa does is he takes out, just sort of ruthlessly excises all of the emotionally sort of work that Ravishena does through his poetics. And he makes the story about understanding these very basic character traits that he attaches and sort of hammers home for each character. So Ravana becomes an exemplar of pride and egoism. And it's very clear and consistent throughout the narrative that that is who Jinadasa thinks Ravana is. Rama is the opposite. He's this sort of peaceful, quiescent warrior, right, who controls his emotions, right? And then the reader tracks, as they read Jinadasa's Sanskrit Padma Purana, exactly what befalls each character because of these singular character traits. And so the moral work of Jinadasa's Sanskrit text is really in intellectually understanding the need to sort of dampen or control or discipline the kshayas, these passions that arise in Jainism, and the threat that can occur, or the danger of not doing that. So Ravana going to hell is clearly a repercussion of him not working to tamp down or discipline his ego. And so the reader sort of learns that. But all of this sort of poetics just gets in the way for Jinadasa. It distracts from the sort of timely progress of the narrative. And so he just gets rid of it.
So before we talk a bit more about the getting rid of it, tell us a bit more about that tantalizing thought of the prowess of emotional manipulation on behalf of an author.
Yeah, so Ravishena is really good at, I don't mean manipulation negatively, I just mean it factually, right? And so the way that he does it in the Padma Purana is, first and foremost, he gets us to really like Ravana. The reader encounters Ravana as the first main character of the story. Like I said, he's a really good Jain king. He's just, he's fair. He's on this just mission to reclaim his homeland of Lanka, which had been taken from him by a rival clan. And he goes about doing that in a just and good way. And so the reader spends a lot of time with Ravana, learning to like him, learning to think of him as a friend, while of course also knowing in the back of their minds what is going to happen to him, that he is going to die, right? And so when he eventually dies at the hands of Lakshmana, the reader is meant to feel really sad. They're supposed to experience grief at the fact of losing this friend, right? Ravishena sort of plays on that, or plays that up even more He builds up, Ravana is this amazing sort of just, righteous, strong king right up until he abducts Sita. And then there's this sort of drop in his character, and he becomes this sort of pitiful, whiny individual when Sita doesn't respond to him the way he wants, right? And so there's this precipitous drop that the reader is supposed to feel bad about, and then it just leads to him dying. And then nothing happens. And so Ram gives this sort of cursory explanation of it was Ravana's fate to die, to be killed. It's all just workings of karma. This explanation of karma doesn't alleviate any of the grief that Ravana or that the reader actually feels, right? And so they're sort of left with this unresolved grief. And what finally resolves that is at the end of the story, when Lakshmana dies through a trick of two gods, and the reader experiences or sort of equates the grief that Ram feels with their own grief. Ram goes through 6 months of sort of refusing to believe that his brother has died. He carries around his corpse with him for 6 months and won't let anyone perform the funerary rites that are necessary. Until finally, Ram understands that the only way to alleviate this grief is through renunciation and becoming a good Digambara Jain monk. And that sort of points the reader towards the fact that if they want to alleviate their own grief, they should do the same thing. And so, again, it's this emotional attunement to the universality of grief that the reader experiences, and then being led to not the amelioration not only of one's individual grief, but of the universality of grief through renunciation. And so that's how Ravi Shaina sort of points you towards that. And it's just amazingly skillful. It is this just beautiful work of Sanskrit that culminates, I think, perfectly.
Lovely. And yet 8 centuries later, we have Jinasena ripping it apart. You know, this is a lovely little lion. I think we need to shave the mane off and, you know, clip a bit of the whiskers and, you know, have him slouch a bit. And no, so Jinadasa, revolutionizes this in his retelling. And I guess what I want to ask is, how much do we know about his context? And the reason I'm asking that is, to what extent do you think what he's doing is a response to his times, or just owing to his own personal theological needs or his personality quirks? Like, what's driving his project?
Yeah, there's this really interesting sort of passage in Ravi Shaina, in the first chapter, that describes different types of listeners or hearers of the story of Ram, right? And how they will respond to it. And it's pretty brief. I think it's only like 4 verses. And in Jinadasa's retelling, it is the only place in the narrative where he actually expands upon what Ravi Shaina writes. So he adds like 10 more possibilities of listeners, right? And sort of explains again how they will respond to it. And so in the book, I talk about like, Jinadasa clearly thinks his world is more complicated in a way. There are more possibilities of who people are and how they will respond to this narrative. And in that world that is more complicated, he wants precision. And he wants, as he explicitly says, he wants clarity. What I try to do in the book is be careful about saying that a complicated world doesn't mean a worse world in particular, right? It doesn't mean that things are worse off than they were in Ravi Shaina's. He sees a more complicated world that the story needs to be updated to work in, right? And he doesn't see this highly poetic, emotionally manipulative work that Ravi Shaina has written as capable of working in the proper way that the Ram story should. And so that's why he goes about intentionally streamlining the narrative and creating clarity out of what he sees as being unclear.
I find that fascinating for a variety of reasons that I probably won't go into on this podcast. What do you hope folks most take away from this work?
So I wrote the book intentionally thinking of sort of different audiences. Obviously, it participates in discussions within Jain studies, and I try to model a sort of reading strategy in a way of generating questions that gets the field out of just sort of reading a text to sort of find the ahimsa, right? Like I found the nonviolence, and so now I know why this thing is Jane, right? I try to get us out of that a bit to think of Jain authors as full participants in the world of pre-modern Sanskrit and Bhasha narrative composition, right? And so I hope to do that for people sort of in the field of Jain studies. I think it's important for people who are interested in Sanskrit and vernacular literature to read, to understand what Jains were doing. They're still understudied, I think, in the history of Sanskrit literature. And a lot of them were really good authors. Ravi Shaina, I don't think, was writing just for Jains. I think taking the work seriously as a kavya necessitates thinking beyond just a Jain audience, right? Any sort of emotionally refined, attuned person should understand and be affected by the work of Ravi Shaina, right?
Sorry, just really briefly before I forget, an analog that comes to mind is that Italian operas aren't just for people who speak Italian.
Right? Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And then I think I want people to understand that Jainism historically and literarily is and always has been just as diverse and interesting as any other South Asian religious tradition. There's a trend, I think, in Jainism to want it to be, or to think of it at least, as a bit monolithic, right? It has always been the same, that the tenets, the foundations have always been the same and have been expressed in the same way. And I want people to understand that that's not the case.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's the temptation is to perhaps a la many world religion textbooks, or you know, just the temptation is to think of Jain as a side dish, Jainism as a side dish of Hinduism, or a distillation of something therein, or take Hindu principles, ascetic ideology, take them to their extreme, tack on some interesting practices and names, and there you've got Jainism.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there for different sort of political and historical reasons, Jinnadasa lived in the 15th century, which has been largely overlooked in the study of Jainism until very recently. It was seen as this sort of degraded time period and where Jain monastics sort of weren't really fulfilling their vows, and so therefore it wasn't really worthy of study. And so bringing, Jinnadasa wrote between 60 and 80 works in like a 20-year time frame. He was an incredibly prolific author in multiple languages, right? So in trends in South Asian studies, Indian religious studies, right? Jains have a place there, and I'm trying to contribute to that as well.
Comes to mind, actually, I can't remember. I mean the timeless time of our COVID hangover in the podcast land, and so I don't know if it was last year or when it was. Don't ask me. But at some point in the not too recent past, this podcast was renamed by yours truly, New Books in Indian Religions, and you probably were listening to it when it was New Books in Hindu Studies, and we all know that Hinduism is a problematic word for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. But more practically speaking than to split an intellectual hair, yep. there's so much that falls into what we could think of as Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, mm-hmm. that that so enriches how we think of Hinduism and vice versa. And this monograph is, you know, a prime example of why this seems to be New Books in Indian Religions, because certainly this has much to say about Ramayana traditions and compositional mm-hmm. practices in South Asia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you mentioned this in passing when I asked you about the key takeaways, but let's just make it a little more clear. Who would most benefit from reading this book? What kinds of folks?
Everyone.
yes, everyone. Immediately.
you know, I think people who are interested in the ethical work of narrative literature, right? And I mean that not only within religious studies, I mean that certainly not even, you know, within Jain studies, but anyone who's interested in thinking about how narrative creates ethical subjects, right? Or how narrative trains people to read itself to become better people. That's absolutely one of the sort of key themes and sort of contributions of the book. And also, I think what I've tried to do is be explicit, particularly in introduction, about how I came to the questions I ask of my materials, and how they are not the only questions that you could ask of these materials, and how they are very specific given my reading of the field of Jain studies, the field of South Asian narrative. And so I try to be really clear and upfront and honest about why I'm asking the questions I'm asking. And so people who are, I think, you know, particularly graduate students, people who are trying to think of coming up with projects, I intentionally wrote the book to be honest about why I'm asking the questions I'm asking and how I came to those questions. And so people who are thinking about how do I develop a project? How do I ask interesting questions? How do I make contributions to fields, right? Not sort of searching for capital T truth, but I'm making contributions to fields that I'm participating in and that I value. And that doesn't have to be Jainism. It can be anything.
It's evident to me, or at least I'll say it's my perception. How's that? To me, when I read the book, it's clear that the person writing the book is can and or enjoys teaching.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. the book, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, this is our first conversation, mm-hmm. but you can tell with the cues, like when someone is speaking to an audience as if you want to make sure they stay along with you.
Yeah.
You know, I think in your last, in your concluding chapter, you know, you basically have a subheading of like one of the core questions I asked in this podcast geared at public education. So what's the takeaway? What are the key takeaways in case you weren't paying attention, in case you fell asleep halfway?
Yeah.
Here are the takeaways.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really important. I mean, you know, it's not a particularly long book, but I think it is a complicated book insofar as some of the texts have the same name, right? I'm talking about the same characters throughout the entire thing. There's a lot that I think readers could get sort of bogged down in. And so I did really intentionally want to take a step back and say, you know, these are the key things that you need to take away from this book. I think being open about that is a positive. I think it's good. I don't think your reader should have to search for what your contribution is. And so I tried to be really clear and explicit about that. And also the ways in which I think either I or people in the future could move forward with the sort of questions I'm asking. There's an entire sort of table in the conclusion of the book that just lists other Jain Ramayanas that people have not worked on, right? So I also try to point people in future directions and to say, I don't think I wrote the book on Ravi Shaina. I don't think I wrote the book on Jinadasa. I think I asked two or three particular questions of these texts. I think I provide an answer to them, and other people can ask different questions or future questions or similar questions of different materials and add to the contribution that I think I'm making. And that's what scholarship is to me.
The best book, I've said it before, I'll say it again, the best books are beginnings, right? scholarly books. Mm-hmm. I mean, the best scholarly books in their beginnings. They just unturn a stone and they're far from perfect. My work on the Devi Mahatmya is far from perfect, but one imagines it's not without insight.
Absolutely.
One hopes it's not without insight. And perhaps the methods that I sort of iron out can be used elsewhere or improved upon, and hopefully they will be, right? And so it's evident that your project's a textual one. The giveaways that we've only been talking about texts. But I think we should touch a little more on the methodology, particularly with respect to your engagement of narrative. Could you say a bit about if any theorist or idea informs consciously or unconsciously your approach to narrative?
So I think Buddhist studies has done some really interesting work on the sort of moral power of narratives. I'm thinking of Charles Halsey and Anne Hansen's article, and they rely on Ricoeur a lot for their article on that. I quote that. And so their sort of idea is that what narrative allows is for you to sort of leave your own identity behind and enter earnestly into the narrative, and that the possibilities once you've done that are sort of endless, right? And that's where the moral work of narrative occurs. And that I agree with. As far as a sort of theoretical approach to reading these texts in particular, I cite and work with J.Z. Smith, who is very clear about difference being what is important about a comparative project. And also, I'm forgetting his name right now, which is really bad.
Nothing is good or bad. I had a teacher who once used to say, "Nothing is good or bad. Thinking makes it so." So no.
I just looked over at my bookshelf. Dominic LaCapra, who talks about reading texts not being sort of defined by the sort of circumstances of their creation or of their being written, right? So there's a trend, and I think Jain studies has sort of adopted this trend of thinking circumstantially as defining what texts mean. And I sort of try to bracket off circumstances to a degree and really try to figure out what the text is telling me, and think of cues that authors are leaving as to how the text should be read.
You're completely speaking my language. So much of just reading texts and reading people and reading life have just been internalized through observation over the years, but a simple but powerful idea of the semiotician Umberto Eco is that the text it's crafted to tell you how it wants to be read. And of course we're not like, of course nothing comes arrives in a vacuum. Of course knowledge for the world beyond the text is only going to help you. But it's not, but that text does have agency for, you know, anyone with a human psyche.
Absolutely. And it's a fine line between thinking and allowing context to influence and allowing context to predetermine. And so what I'm really trying to make sure I'm not doing is allowing context to predetermine. And so another way, and I talk about this a bit in the introduction to the book, of thinking about this is the vocabulary of framing, which I take from John Court, one of the big players in Jain studies, allowing questions to frame your approach to text with the understanding, just like in art, that a different frame will change the way you perceive the piece of art, right? Asking different questions of a text will bring certain aspects to the fore, will allow other aspects of the text to sort of fade into the background. And that's okay. As long as you're upfront and clear and honest about how you're framing your approach to your reading.
Again, that really resonates.
And all of that is inspired and I sort of imbibed from Anne Monius, who was my PhD advisor, and was the greatest advisor on the planet. So,
I actually ended up going to Calgary to do a PhD in Canada, in and out as best I could. By some minor miracle, I finished it in 4 years. But I went to work with Elizabeth Rollman, who was a student of Anne Monius. So,
and first PhD student.
And I was Beth's first PhD student. So there you go. The power of Parampara at the Academy. Yeah, so without question, her influence on Beth Rollman has definitely infiltrated my own studies. It was actually Beth who attunes me to Umberto Eco. She uses Eco for the graduate reading course.
Okay, yeah.
And it just, it stayed with me. And then it wasn't until I was turning up my dissertation when I thought I need to think of, you know, like, and it was a little bit backwards in that, like, I know how I read these texts, but I don't know what theory to point to mm-hmm. to explain how I read these texts.
Yep.
And there it was.
One of the big things in moving from dissertation to book was how I talked about theory, actually. And so when I rewrote the introduction to talk about the book, I tried to be more explicit about, this is the way that theory has influenced how I think, and I'm not applying theory to text. I'm applying theory to myself, and that is going to influence in X, Y, and Z ways the way that I read these texts. So how we
that's
talk and think
vital,
theory, yeah,
that's a vital, vital distinction.
Yeah,
that, I mean, in my view, that's wise. Like, I'm currently teaching a reading course. I'm on the Devi Mahatmya at a fantastic platform called Yogic Studies, actually set up by by Seth Powell at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm saying to them, listen, guys, before you read me or Doniger or anyone else, read the Devi Mahatmya over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, read the text first, you know, exclusively.
Yep.
And then, you know, and this principle just pervades my life. I can't imagine watching a review of a Game of Thrones episode before watching the episode. I mean, sure, I don't understand.
Yeah.
But I think that idea is very important, the primacy of the text and the primacy of engaging the text and really getting familiar with it, because it will impact how you think of it.
Yep.
Familiarity will inform
the research. Yeah, when I was first starting the research for this, you know, Anne's recommendation was you just need to wallow in the text for a while. You need to just be with the text and sit with them and read them and allow them to sort of wash over you in a way. And then you can start thinking about questions, and then you can start thinking about answers to those questions. But you need access and time with the text themselves.
Fascinating. It's unsurprising. I mean, the story of Rama is so gripping. I literally was pulled into grad school because I could not. I love narrative. I started off as an English major, then I dropped out. Long story. Returned to study Hinduism, essentially. I knew that Rama's coronation day and his exile on that day, I knew that there was something really important happening there, and I couldn't begin to make sense of it. Like, why on earth are they celebrating? Yes, he's being a great sage, but he's being a terrible king, a terrible son, even. His father wants him to be locked up, basically. What's going on here? And so it's unsurprising that the story is so fascinating that it's gripped by many a Jain thinker as well. And and the way I view the Valmiki Ramayana, or the Ramayana traditions in general, is this sort of interplay between royal and ascetic ideologies, right? And it's interesting that in the Jain context, it's like, no, for Rama to be the hero, he has to be, he has to swing much more towards the Nivritti, the sort of the ascetic ideology, and he has to really eschew the Kshatriya Dharma. And I find that endlessly fascinating, because one would imagine that that is a crucial aspect of Rama's heroism. And yet the Jains completely rework that.
And it's also, I mean, one of the great things about Jain Ramayana is that there is so much innovation within what is essentially, you know, a predetermined outcome, right? The Baladeva is always going to end up renouncing the world, right? And he's going to become a monk, and he's going to achieve liberation at the end of his life, right? That's going to happen. Lakshmana, you know, the Vasudeva and the Prativasudeva, the same thing is going to happen to them in every time, right? In every retelling of the story. And so within what could be seen as sort of strictures, right, as limiting factors, Jain authors have been really good about finding ways to tell aspects of it anew, or to prioritize different either emotional or theological aspects, right? And in that process, to talk about ethics, to talk about morality, to talk about what it means to be a good person in new and interesting ways. And so creativity out of what can be seen limitations, I just find really fascinating. And that's something that Jains do really well.
That's a wonderful note to end on, I feel. But before we do formally end, was there anything else about the book that you hoped we touch on? I was maybe a little more vocal than in some podcasts, because I seem to like this topic. But was there anything else you wanted us to touch on?
I guess I'll just say, you know, the second half of the book is about the vernacular. It's called the Ram Ras. It's Srinivasa's vernacular work. And there I really rely on, or I guess lean into the idea that this Ras text was supposed to be performed, and then sort of think about what does a Ram text from a Jain mean when it's performed? Who is the audience of such a text? And what does that mean for sort of ethical development or the development of moral persons? And so a lot of what I do there, I make the argument that in performance, or if we think about the sort of historical situatedness of a performance, who's going to come to a performance of a Ramayana? Everyone's going to come. And so it's one of, I sort of make the argument that, again, we need to think beyond just Jains as audience members or readers or listeners to this text. We should be confident in the fact that even Jain authors could talk about ethics in ways that were effective on non-Jains. And we need to think about the ways in which pre-modern South Asians could think about their own identity in more ways than just religious identity. So Jains were Jains, but they were other things, and those identities could sometimes compete, sometimes be complementary. And if we only privilege religious identity, we miss out on a lot of interactions and a lot of possibilities for moral work of text. And so that's what I do in the sort of second half, or I guess part three of the book.
Fascinating. So having been, in your words, a longtime listener, was it what you expected? What was it like being on the podcast?
Great. I always like talking about this. You know, I'm sure as everyone who's written a book, I'm sure you know this, I am simultaneously excited for this to be out and so sick of it and done with it and just want it to be out in the world, right? Like, I'm excited, but this was my dissertation. I've been working on this for 10 years. I'm done and ready to move on to something else to a degree as well. So, yeah.
So then let's end with this question, which I typically would end with for a phase of the podcast. What is the next step? What are you working on next?
So I'm currently working on a translation of a text. Part of my interest in Jain literature has become, I want more people to be able to read it. And that it necessarily involves translation. And so I'm working on translation of a text called the Varanga Charita, the Deeds of Prince Varanga, which is a 7th century Sanskrit text written by a Jain monk named Jatasimha Nandi. There's this really interesting story. And so that is ongoing. It's the beginning stages. I've proposed that to the Murti Classical Library of India series, and they want to see more translation. So hopefully that will work out. I'm finishing up some sort of smaller projects at the moment, but the next big monograph project is going to be about King Srenika as a literary character. And so King Srenika is sort of omnipresent in Jain narrative literature. He is the sort of perfect listener. He receives all of these stories from, usually from Gautama, Mahavir's sort of primary disciple. And so he goes and approaches Mahavir, asks, for instance, that the true story of Ram be told, right? And he's sort of everywhere. And I want to look at the ways in which Jain lay identity, we can think about that as changing through the lens of King Srenika. So in the early modern period, new texts begin to be written that center Srenika as the protagonist of his own narrative. And so I want to see the ways in which depictions and sort of engagements with Srenika as a literary character change historically and what we can say about Jain identity because of that.
Yeah, fascinating enterprise. What comes to mind is, Brian Collins looking at Parashurama, or Adi Sate looking at Vishwamitra, right? Yep. I have in the back of my brain a book at some point called Mapping Markandeya, where we just nerd out on Markandeya. Yep. Does Markandeya say? Who is he putting together over? Because, you know, he's an ancient sage that appears in a number of places.
Yeah.
So that should be a cool project.
And what inspired that project actually is this weird, it's to me a conundrum where Srenika has access to the Jinnah, right? Like he hears from the Jinnah, he hears all this stuff, it should work on him, right? And yet he ends his life by suicide. And so how can this person who has access to the dharma of an enlightened being, right? Seemingly at the end of his life, not have imbibed anything, right? So that's sort of the crux of what has interested me in Srinika as a literary character.
We should speak about that at some point. That's fascinating. So thanks again for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Gregory M. Kleins of Trinity University. We've been speaking about this brand new 2022 Routledge publication, Jane Romina Narratives, Moral Vision and Literary Innovation. Until next time, keep listening. Stay safe.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
I'll just add, the book is available open access for free to download, thanks to the generous support of my institution. So you can access it right now, and you can download it for free. So,
and that link will be in the podcast notes. That is a very important point. And I'm glad that was raised, because I was not aware of that. So it'll be in the podcast notes. You can click right now and get the book in your hot little hands. Great. So for those listening, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the intersection of morality and narrative. Take care.